Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 13th, Friday the 13th. Oh my God. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, but instead from the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. It is, I am here for the 2018 Mass Torts Conference, and just realized it's Friday the 13th, so all of my plans to win back my money seem perilous. On the program today, Trump expected to pardon Cheney aide Scooter Libby. Yes, folks.
Deep cut.
Yep. Going way back, just for the sake of setting up the idea that he can pardon people. Meanwhile, apparently Trump's friends are a little bit concerned that the feds may have recordings made by his attorney, Michael Cohen.
Everybody thought that we would just have a low-key criminal enterprises, and then I became president. Whoops.
What are you going to do? We thought we would laugh and laugh about the tapes. But meanwhile, Trump is revisiting, and folks, surprise, surprise, the TPP. Meanwhile, Comey, Comey, Comey. And drug executives are set now to testify before Congress in May about their role in the U.S. opioid epidemic. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, I am in Las Vegas, The downside is that sometimes it's tough to track down some guests. The good side is that when you do, I have the opportunity to pre-record. We had a guest cancel this morning. Fortunately, yesterday, I had run into Tom Hartman and had an opportunity to sit down with him. And another interview I did with an attorney that I've interviewed before on this program, who is an international human rights attorney. In the past, we've talked about his tracking of funds through banks that end up supporting terrorism. Banks and, frankly, corporations, usually oil companies. I'll be talking to him later in a pre-recorded interview I did yesterday about his suit on behalf of Kurds and Iranians who were subject to chemical warfare under the Saddam Hussein regime in the 80s, his suit against a German conglomerate that built the chemical weapons factories. Fascinating.
Which one was it? Is it Siemens or what company?
It's now called TUI, T-U-I. Okay. It was a different company at the time, and we'll talk more about that later. I'm also going to speak to an attorney who's working on a another medical device suit. So we will get to all of that in a moment. Of course, Tom Hartman, not an attorney, but is here, does his show from here as well, because he gives him an opportunity to talk to some of these folks as well. Let me remind you, ladies and gentlemen, as I am here in Las Vegas amassing a fortune. It's a little bit less of a fortune than it was yesterday, but for me, I no longer assess winning by a dollar figure. I look at it more at, like, how much time did I spend?
Winning's a state of mind, Sam.
Exactly.
How much fun did you have?
I have a lot of fun. I love to play blackjack. Mm. And I saw an old buddy who I had seen here 3 years ago, who is a dealer here.
Well, that's cool.
And so that's sort of fun. And he's always got a lot to say. Let me just also remind you of this. We all know that window treatments is a it's sort of one of those like soulless adulting terms.
Mm.
But it's pretty necessary stuff. You don't think about your blinds unless they break or you move. But when they're right, everything in your home looks better. When they're wrong, everything in your home looks bad. And it's true. It makes a huge difference, folks. And with that said, picking them out can be both a pain in the butt and, frankly, somewhat boring and maybe even intimidating in some ways.
Arduous.
Definitely.
It is intimidating, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why I don't do it.
Yeah, I think that is, there's just something about it that makes you feel like I'm going to get it wrong, and they're not going to look good, and I'm going to have hung them up, and I'm going to hang them up wrong. I don't think that way, but I know Michael does. But they
my blinds actually look great. That's kind of the dirty little secret of this whole segment. But
wow.
Yeah.
Blinds.com makes it super easy for you. If you're not sure what you want or even where to start, with Blinds.com, you get a free online design consultation. You just send them pics of your house or your apartment. They send back custom recommendations from a professional for what will work with the colors in your apartment or house, your furniture, whatever the specific room is. They'll even send you free samples to make sure that everything looks good in person as it does online. And, of course, every order gets free shipping. And this is the best part. If you accidentally mismeasure, which happens, I mean, you're supposed to measure twice so that you cut only once. But if you don't, and even if you mismeasure twice or you pick the wrong color or whatever it is, you screw up, Blinds.com will remake your blinds for free. They made it super easy for you, so there's no excuse to be waking up every morning with the sun shining in your eyes because you don't have any blinds.
Mm.
For a limited time, you can get up to 20% off of everything at Blinds.com when you use the promo code MAJORITY. It's Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY for up to 20% off everything. You can get the faux wood blinds, the wood blinds, the cellular shades, the roller shades, more. Check it out. Go to Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY. Of course, as everything in life, ladies and gentlemen, rules and restrictions apply. All right, so we're going to take a quick break and go to an interview that I did with Tom Hartman yesterday. It's always a pleasure for me to talk to Tom because I start out thinking like, okay, we're going to talk about the news a little bit, and the conversation always expands and then turns harrowing. But
sounds nice.
Yeah, of course.
I think what you're trying to say is he's got a nice historical awareness.
Yes, okay. And and a grim view of the future.
Oh, right, fair enough.
But and then we'll when we come back, we got a couple other interviews that we're going to be doing, and obviously a lot of news as always in the Trump era. All right, quick break. We get back. Tom Hartman. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. I am in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Mass Torts Conference 2018, and it is a huge honor and pleasure for me to welcome to the program Tom Hartman. Perhaps many of you have heard of him. He is, of course, syndicated nationally. You're the biggest left liberal talker in the country.
Yeah.
Right? And have
for
been,
better or worse.
Be that as it may, and it's been like that for
about a decade.
Yeah, exactly. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. So
glad to be with you, Sam.
All right,
it's an honor and a pleasure to be with you, too.
I
really
appreciate
is.
It. Well, I want to talk about your piece. That
Plus, it's nice to hang out with a friend.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot. Walking around Las Vegas, it's nice to see a face I recognize.
Yeah.
All right, well, so, okay, I want to talk about your piece in Alternate about Paul Manafort, which I found just fascinating.
And,
but let's, you know, we run into each other at these conferences every year or two, maybe. Mm. And I want to get your take on what's going on politically.
Yeah.
You know, from a 20,000 foot view, because obviously, you know, we're recording this on Thursday. I'm going to play it on Friday.
Right.
And it could be a week's worth of news before we get there
sure.
tomorrow morning. But, I mean, give me your perspective of what's happening at this point.
I think what is really going on is that when Ronald Reagan married Nancy Davis, and he was a Democrat at the time and a union guy, and her father said to him, son, you know, I can make you rich and I can make you powerful, but you got to leave those Democrats. You know, you're going to have to come with us. Come with the billionaires. Now, back then it was multimillionaires, but you get the point. And he got him into the GE Theater and all this stuff. That was the beginning. That coincided with the Powell memo and all that stuff that was going on in the early 70s. That was the beginning of the rise of the corporate takeover of America. And Reagan then, when he became president, institutionalized that. And we have been in the Reagan era ever since. Clinton didn't turn it back. Obama didn't turn it back. Carter didn't turn it back. I mean, we are still in the Reagan era. And what we're seeing right now is in the Trump administration, and not just in Trump himself, but although it is in Trump himself. I mean, he's just carrying out traditional, classic, so-called Republican, so-called conservative issues that Dwight Eisenhower would vomit over, frankly, or my father, who was an Eisenhower Republican. We're seeing these guys in Pruitt and Zinke and all these guys with all these policies, basically turning America, turning the infrastructure of America, turning the commons of America, turning the assets of America, turning the lives of Americans over to the predations of these sociopathic corporations. And corporations, by definition, are sociopathic because they only have one mission, which is to make
right.
profit. And the sociopaths who, in many cases, run and control them, and some of the sociopathic billionaires who have gotten that way from these corporations and now are using that money to consolidate their power and wealth.
Hey, give me a sense. I mean, as you say this, you know, Eisenhower would vomit over himself to see yeah. this type of thing. What was a Republican then? I mean, because I think, you know, clearly we have seen this pushback coming from the 60s and, out of the 60s. So this big pushback, and maybe it wasn't even a pushback. Maybe it was, an initial push of the corporate state. I mean, which is not to say that there wasn't, we had robber barons in different
sure.
eras, but and certainly under Reagan, there was all sorts of sort of tax machinations and, sort of stock buybacks and whatnot, which have led us to where we are now. But what was an Eisenhower Republican like?
Well, first let's go from 30,000 feet to 90,000 feet and look at America from basically the 1830s until today. And we've had two really major periods three major periods of reform. On everything except war, and that was the Civil War and the period, the 10 years immediately following it, and then pushback against that reform, which was
so we had Reconstruction, and then we had Jim Crow,
right? And then you had Jim Crow, and that led up to another reform era, which Teddy Roosevelt sort of started, but it got squashed, and World War I and all that, and then FDR brought it into being, and then. That FDR era lasted. Eisenhower was all in favor of FDR's programs, the majority of them, and many Republicans were. And that lasted until, I would say until Nixon, until 68. And Nixon began this process of taking America down, back down into oligarchy. And so what we have, we're now very much like the robber baron era, the Gilded Age. I mean, you had the Gilded Age, and then you had the Roaring Twenties, and then you got now. And so what Republicans were before they embraced the robber barons, before they embraced the Gilded Age. And by the way, let's keep in mind, each Gilded Age has, all three of them arguably, has led to a collapse because it's always filled with excess. And then that out of that collapse has come a reformation. So, you know, there's kind of good news here, too. But the Republicans of the 50s and 60s, and I'm old enough to remember that. I was born in 51. My dad was an Eisenhower Republican. In 1964, I was 13 years old. I went door-to-door with my dad for Barry Goldwater. And you know, 2 years later, I was fighting with my dad about politics, and he threw me out of the house. But the Republicans at that time, their major difference with the progressives was, I mean, they wanted change too, but they wanted it slowly, gradually, and carefully. They were literally conservative. Of course we want to move forward into the future, but let's not do it in a way that's dangerous. Let's not do it in a way that's going to break things. Let's just be cautious and careful, step by step about this. Test things, micro change. And you know, for some, that was an excuse to hold back progress, to fight against Brown v. Board, for example. But for most, it was like, yeah, of course, we've got to do this, but let's do this, whatever this may mean. Let's do this incrementally. Now, I didn't agree with that, you know, throughout most of my life. I was in favor of fast change, and I still am. But that, you know, just knowing my dad, knowing the Republican Party in the 60s, knowing how these people think, having read Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind, you know, which published in 1952, which arguably kicked off the whole Goldwater and then, you know, everything else. I think that that's probably the best description of it. And then the Republican Party got basically taken over by crazies.
And this was, I mean, because there's still, and this comes up less frequently, it seems to me, but we still hear this notion of like, look, we all agree on, you know, what we want for society. We just disagree on how to get there, which I don't think is actually true. You're expressing that, well, that may have been true.
I think
in
it was true on the ground.
40,
you know, 40s. I'm not sure if my dad was a victim of a BS campaign in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. Or if a lot of people in the Republican Party actually believed that, you know, but conservatism was a very, very different thing. It has gone.
The argument used to be about the approach as opposed to the
goal.
The goal.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, conservatives would say, yeah, you know, we're in favor of a clean environment. We're in favor of, you know, racial reunification, and we're in favor of you know, modernity, but we just want to get there slowly.
And race, it seems to me, either undergirds or overlaps with what you're talking about. Well,
sure.
All of it, yes, definitely.
Yeah, from the founding of the country,
but
I mean,
not necessarily separated from when we're talking about parties, because of course, you know, we had a shift in the 60s, where, you know, it was sort of a realignment in terms of where parties were on some level.
Sure.
And we have a lot of examples going through the New Deal where African Americans were shortchanged and you know, by design. So we're in this era now where Donald Trump is in many respects the culmination of what really this 40-year project, I guess, 50 yeah. almost 50 years now of conservative.
Right.
I don't know.
And what I would say, and to the article in Alternate, is that when the corporate powers, the billionaire powers, hijacked the conservative movement and the Republican Party, they realized that if they just came out and said, you know, we just want to corporatize America. We don't want there to be a public sector. We don't want there to be a commons. We want to steal everything that's not nailed down. We believe in oligarchy. We believe in aristocracy, essentially. We are neo-Calvinists. You know, John Calvin, back, you know, in the 1600s, the question was, okay, if you're going to have a democracy, how do you figure out who to rule you? Because, you know, Thomas Hobbes told us that all men are evil. You know, the right. Bible tells us it's original sin. People are evil. And so how do we find those people who have been blessed by God, who have been purged of their evil? And John Calvin's theory was, well, they're the rich ones.
Right.
You know, that's the proof of God's blessing. And so they kind of assembled all this stuff into a weird kind of chaotic theory. But they really realized that in order to gain and hold political power, they had to bring along the white racists in a big way. In America, you know, back then it was 80% white, now it's 70% white, more or less. I mean, they needed to really bring those people in, and that was the brilliant, and I say that in the evil genius context, the brilliance of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. Was, you know, as Lee Atwater said, you can't say N-word anymore.
Right.
You got to say, instead, force busing. Now, then, as we got into the 70s and 80s, into the 80s, I mean, Atwater laid this right out. I'm sure you played that famous quote that I think David Korn found years ago, that Atwater said, instead of even force busing now, instead we talk about economic issues, which hurt blacks worse than whites, because they're the most fragile and vulnerable.
Right.
And our people know what we're talking about, but the moderates don't. So they'd bring along people like my dad, you know, it's not wanting to always go back to him, but in any case. And that's what Manafort did. I mean, you know.
Yeah, this was, I mean, that's what Paul Manafort is sort of like the Zelig of Southern strategy. Race leveraging race in the wake of the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, he's the most famous Machiavellian bigot that nobody's ever heard of. I mean, you know, until he hooked up with Trump, he ran Reagan's Southern strategy.
All right. Well, so tell people, I mean, Manafort. I mean, you know, because people, I certainly when you said this to me, I was like, oh, it's Atwater. But Atwater worked
for Manafort.
For Manafort, right. Which I did not realize.
Yeah, yeah. Lee Atwater became an employee of Paul Manafort's consulting company in the 1980s, and on the George Herbert Walker Bush campaign, came up with the Willie Horton ads and all that stuff. He was working for Paul Manafort. These guys they got really really good at reaching out to Southern white people in order to gain national power. It's a large chunk of the country, and the way that the Senate works, even, you know, relatively small states with 3, 4, 8, 7, 8 million people
right.
in them can
have the same,
yeah, you know, have more power than California, or right. the same power as California, or New York, or whatever. And so that Southern strategy was, it wasn't just about, hey, let's reach out to the racists. It was, it was like gerrymandering. How do we reapportion the country so that we will have continuous political power? And the South had always been Democratic, but it had always been Democratic because of race. In other words, the white racists in the South had always voted Democratic, and that George Wallace was a Democrat and all that stuff. And that all the Democratic Party repudiated that in 64. You know, Bill Moyers tells the story of walking into Lyndon Johnson's office the day before he signed the Civil Rights Act.
So we're about to lose the South
for a generation.
And
turns out it was
three generations. Right.
Yeah. And maybe four or five. Who knows? But so that's where we are now. And the thing about Paul Manafort that's just so amazing is that, you know, he started on the tail end of Nixon as a Jerry Ford delegate and then carried that into Reagan and helped make Reagan president. And he's been a Republican fixer ever since, in addition to working for a whole series of
really
brutal
bad
dictators.
Yes. Yeah. And oligarch. I mean, it seemed like Manafort, you know, the sense I get from Manafort is that he found greener pastures, apparently might involve some money laundering, I guess we'll find out,
yeah.
for some of these foreign clients. But he seemed, I guess generationally, it was an easier gig, or maybe he got squeezed out or whatever it was. He started to represent these foreign, like you say, oligarchs and
billionaires. I don't know him, and I've never diagnosed him in person, but I would say that this guy is probably a classic sociopath.
And
he's a man without a soul.
And he seemed to have lost some of his mojo and joined the Trump campaign as a way of basically from what I could tell, why everybody was involved in the Trump campaign. Like, this is going to raise my profile, and I'm going to make some money off it. And then all of a sudden, he wins.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to be what
Oh, they were all in it for the money. Trump was even in it for the money. He even came out and said it. You know, there was that one campaign stop where he said, I'll be the first guy in the history of America to have made money running for the presidency.
Yeah.
And although, you know, he didn't realize that Newt Gingrich did that before him, and Rick Santorum did that.
I was going to say...
That was half the Republican lineup in the
last
two elections.
Yeah, I was going to say that's about the 100% of the Republican lineup. Like, they're still... And I noticed this, like, going in 2012, even in 2016, there's still some sort of, like, notion of, like, oh, well, this person wouldn't run. You know, it's horrible to run for president. It's very difficult. Mm. And nobody would do... And yet... There's mounting evidence, at least on the Republican side. Like, I don't think it's really quite the case. You know, ask Martin O'Malley how successful he's been in his failed bid for the presidency. That there's real money to be made on the right. To run. I mean, you know, this is like Pat Paulson stuff. Right.
And they set up super PACs and they raise millions of dollars. And then under the new laws, once you're no longer running, you can basically convert that money into your own personal use. You've got to jump through some legal hoops.
It's like everything's like a leveraged buyout, it seems to be, right? It's like I'm going to raise money on behalf of this.
It's the Bain Capital
model that
Romney made so famous.
Yes. And you go around and, you know, it added a decade to Newt Gingrich's, you know, sort of public persona. All right, so, but here we are, and you're anticipating another reformation. How does this happen?
Reformations almost always follow crashes. The one that happened in 1901, you know, following the assassination of, what was his name, who was Teddy Roosevelt's president, elected in 1900. In any case, it was the crash of 1896-1897. It was a major economic crash. That kicked off the Progressive Era, but it wasn't big enough or deep enough to really get its roots into all of America, and whereas the crash of 29 was.
Right.
So, two thoughts on that. The first is that it seems, if you look at the history, if you look at the arc of history, just of the United States, but I think you can apply this to world history as well, that crises, crashes and wars, major crashes and major wars, lead to an opportunity to reconstruct things. And my concern is that the billionaire class in America right now is trying to so rig the system, so rig the game, that even if there's another crash and a war like there was in 29 in World War II, that we won't come out of that with a new deal. That we'll come out of that still stuck in the corporate state.
Wasn't that the story of 2008?
No, they stopped it. We're still in the crash of 2008. It's still going on. I mean, they have not reformed any of those things. We're basically in the exact same place. They're holding it back. You know, it's like fingers in the dike, you know, bailing wire and bubblegum. The second thing is that there are
speak a little bit more to that, because we've had a slow diminution of wages over the past 50 years. Certainly, people under the age, I think I saw recently a statistic, you know, it has been 80 and 90 years. People under the age of 40, I think it is, have less money now than in any previous generation in the past, whatever, half dozen.
Since the 30s.
Yeah. And so is this, I mean, are we in a slow motion, like, sort of decline? I mean, wasn't 2008, there was an opportunity maybe to have some real more fundamental reform than we saw?
There seems to be a cycle to American history. And a famous philosopher once said, when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable.
Right.
And this 80-year cycle, it's a four-generation cycle. And each generation is roughly 20 years. And it starts out with a generation that experiences
crisis. Is it Strauss?
Strauss and Howe, yeah. Right. This is fourth-turning
stuff.
Now,
this is you and Bannon. Right? Doesn't Bannon also...
Yeah, I wrote a book about this, Crash
2016. Yeah. All right, go ahead, continue. I'm sorry.
So you got this first generation that goes through crisis and shock and war. And they then give birth to a generation that quietly rebuilds the country, my dad's generation. And then they give birth to a generation that says, you know, our parents worked their asses off, and this didn't seem to be all that, you know, what was the point? And so they go off in search of spiritual meaning and things like that. And that was the transcendentalists back in the day, and,
sure.
and that was the hippies and the generation that I was part of. Social change, political change, I was in SDS, and, you know, and I was also taking acid and getting high. And then that generation gives birth to a generation that says, you know, our parents sat around and gazed at their navels, and it didn't get them anywhere. It didn't get Henry David Thoreau anywhere except in jail. Screw that. I'm going to make money. And then in their embrace of it, this is the fourth generation, in their embrace of that excess, they crash the system. And out of that crash of the system comes another world war. And that's where we're at right now. And those four generations, each one of them 20 years, well, 80 years, literally, 79 years before 2008 was 1929.
Right.
80 years before 1929 or 1930 was the great crash of 1846, which led to the Civil War, or 1856, excuse me. 80 years before that was the great crash of 1700, which led to the American Revolution. So we see these crashes followed by wars, and each war is worse, and each crash seems to be worse. And we were set up, we were ready for that, for this last crash in 2008. I mean, it was time, right? It was just, it was there. We were pregnant with it. And between the plunge protection team and the Fed and the Treasury Department, and literally, I mean, the Fed handed out $27 trillion.
Yep.
Much of it to, like, German oligarchs. I mean, you know, it went to Saudi Arabia. It went all over the world, the money that the Fed gave it, just to hold this off. And they're still holding it off. And federal banks all around the world are holding the worldwide Great Depression off by maintaining totally out of balance fiscal policies that are absolutely unreconcilable with any sort of rational fiscal policy, long-term fiscal policy. But everybody's looking at short-term stuff, and which causes me to think that when this thing comes unraveled, and I think it's probably going to happen in the next couple of years, maybe even in this next year, when this comes unraveled, it's going to be much worse than 2008, and it's going to be on a scale that we saw in 1929 to 1933.
And what's going to precipitate that, though?
I mean, good question. There was a piece in the Financial Times last week about, or this week, Monday or Tuesday it was, about how subprime loans are back for the first time since 2008. More than 40% of people getting loans, excuse me, more than half of people getting loans spend more than 40% of their income on rent and food, which is like absolutely insane, right? We're seeing a student debt crisis. In 2005, right. Joe Biden's bankruptcy bill, him and Debbie Stabenow pushed this thing through. And
You cannot discharge
student loan debt. So we're now $1.4 trillion in student loan debt that's undischargeable. Now, it's unlikely that that's going to be the thing that tips it over, because you can't walk away from a student loan the way you could walk away from a house.
Right.
The bank won't come in and recover it from you and sell it and slightly right. make you whole. But the amount of debt,
and there's not, I mean,
it's going to be a debt crisis, Sam, is the bottom line.
But was it, what, I mean, and it's going to be a private debt crisis.
Yeah. Yes. Not public debt. We don't have a public debt problem yet.
But what is systemic about, let's say, the student loan thing? In other words, the problem was that as soon as housing prices started to fall, the whole, I guess, the whole Ponzi scheme in some ways fell apart too, which right. was that you had all these securities that really weren't what they claimed to be, and they were based upon other derivatives, which were...
They were based on sketchy mortgages, derivatives, yeah.
And it's sort of one card got pulled out. And,
right.
But
they're creating derivatives right now. There's somewhere, and it's really hard to find good numbers on this, because this is all gray market stuff, and it's buried right. in the balance sheets of Wall Street. But you can track it down if you do a pretty good search on the internet. There's somewhere between $5 trillion and $15 to $20 trillion. I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but it's like the entire GDP of the United States in derivatives right now based on student loans and car mortgages, car loans, which are dischargeable.
Mm.
So we're back. right? We're back to this game that these bankers are playing that took us down in 2008 only. And now we've got, you know, mortgage debt too. I think that, you know, we're just massively overstretched. And when this collapses, it's going to collapse real hard.
Well, that's a little bit scary. Maybe we should have stayed closer to 7,000 feet.
Closer to what?
7,000 feet as opposed to 30,000 foot view.
Okay, we can talk there at 7,000 feet. We can get right on the ground if you want.
Well, all right. Well, I mean, I guess,
And the billionaires will do just fine, by the way. The people on Wall Street, they make their money when the market goes up. They make their money when the market goes down.
Of course.
In fact, in most cases,
it's a buying opportunity.
More money when the market goes down. Look at, how the Koch brothers, how much more they're worth now than they were before 2008.
I mean, what do you make of this sort of incredible increase in the stock market? I mean, the stock market, I think, doesn't necessarily implicate people across the country. I mean, 50% of Americans don't own any stock, and then I guess the others are, to the extent that other people
outside
participate.
Outside of the top 3%, it's... You know,
it's pensions and whatnot, which obviously impacts people down the road and their sense of security and whatnot. But what accounts for the rise in the stock market?
It is a bubble being fueled by low interest rates, which is the work of the Fed.
And so, but why now? It's not like interest rates are any lower than they have been over the past 10 years.
Well, this market has been going, 8 years, 10 years, yeah, now.
The past year, it has gone up like,
this is the cancer stage, you know, this is the end stage of a market bubble. And not just a bull market, but a market bubble. And when market bubbles pop, the higher they are, the more radical they get. If you compare the 5-year rise in the stock market to today, to 1929, the period from 1924 to 1929, they're virtually identical.
The graph looks.
It's just a matter of scale. Yeah.
Wow.
And the other thing that's coming along and is going to bite us in the butt is this game Republicans have been playing since Reagan, which is a strategy that was laid out in 1976 by a guy named Jude Winiski in the Wall Street Journal. He laid this out, and he called it the two Santa Claus theory. And he said that in 76, the Republican Party was in the wilderness. They, you know, Jerry Ford had lost. Nixon was, or Ford was president, but, you know, he was not doing anything of consequence. The Nixon scandals had so destroyed the Republican Party that there was actually a serious belief in that party that this party might not last another two decades, that it might just disintegrate.
Right.
And Jude Winiski came along and he said, here's the problem. The Republican Party, the Democratic Party, since 1933, has been seen as the party of Santa Claus. Franklin Roosevelt gave us unemployment insurance. He gave us the WPA and all those. He put us back to work. He gave us Social Security. Lyndon Johnson gave us Medicare and Medicaid. They give us things. They protect us. They're Santa Claus. And the Republicans have always said no to everything. I mean, the Republicans said no to child labor, for God's sake, back in the 30s. You know? And, in fact, there's still some Republicans who think we should do away with
child
labor
laws. I mean, let's face it. You need those 12-year-olds driving tractors.
There you go.
Right?
Absolutely. Well, that argument actually is made.
And
you know that.
Yes.
Yeah. So what Winiski said is when you have a Democrat in office... Well, let's start with Republicans. When you have a Republican in office, he said the day will come when Republicans will control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And it did during Reagan. He said, the Senate and the White House. He said, when you have Republicans in charge, or when you have a Republican in the White House, run the national debt up as hard and as fast as you can. That will make you, and you do it principally by tax cuts. And that makes you seem like Santa Claus. So everybody sits around going, oh, wow, the Republicans gave me a tax cut. They're the tax cut Santa Claus. And then when a Democrat comes into office, starts screaming about the national debt, how it's going to be a disaster, it's going to destroy the country, and force the Democrats to scale back social spending, to shoot their Santa Claus.
Right.
Now, they played this. Reagan tripled the national debt, just short of tripling, and he took it from $800 billion to $2.7 trillion. George W. Bush doubled the national debt. You know, Donald Trump, with this tax bill, this is going to take us to a $30 trillion national debt. And so, you know, this is serious stuff. And they're going to use this, and Paul Ryan has already laid this out.
Oh, sure.
Right after the tax bill was passed, he said, now we have to go after entitlements. So they're going to use this to destroy Social Security. And the other half of that is the Pete Peterson half that nobody ever talks about, which is the other part of the scam that goes to the two Santa Claus scam. And that is that the when George W. Bush was born, he had $1 million trust fund when he was born. It was in treasuries. Treasuries are the safest place to save, to store your money.
Right.
It's this, if you want to save your money, the safest way to do it worldwide is U.S. treasuries, which is U.S. debt. So our debt is actually private savings. You need to realize that. I mean, this is a really important point. Our debt is actually, by and large,
private savings. This is modern monetary
theory. Well, they talk about it, but this is, you know, Franklin Roosevelt talked about this, too. And so the bankers on Wall Street are looking at this going, okay, out of the you know, $18 trillion national debt, probably $12 trillion of it is actually private savings or corporate savings. And they should be borrowing that money, or they should be loaning that money to us. We should be the ones paying them interest on it. You know, this should be our thing, not the federal government's thing. We can make a pay. If we can just skim 0.1% off the top of $14 trillion, we are richer than, you know. And so Pete Peterson, who's a Wall Street billionaire, he just passed away recently, started this Peterson Foundation, and they've been pitching this thing of, oh, the debt, it's a terrible thing, it's going to destroy America, we've got to zero out the debt, we've got to have a balanced budget, we've got to have... Only one time in the history of the United States did a president actually get the national debt down to zero. And that was Andrew Jackson. And it produced a seven-year-long depression, the longest and deepest depression in the history of the United States, because there was no safe place to put money. And the money markets just went nuts. And that's what these guys are fixing to do again. But, you know, they're combining the two Santa Claus theory with the let's privatize the debt thing and turn it all over to the Wall Street banks. And it's just like the worst economic policy you can imagine. It is designed to maximize short-term gains for the billionaire class and the banks and set America up for absolute devastation.
How are they attempting to do that now with the public
debt? They're talking about balanced budget amendments. You know, they just proposed one in Congress. It's not going to pass, but the drumbeats are starting.
Of course. And this is the game they play. But what do you think of modern monetary theory?
I think they're spot on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it seems like it's starting to permeate the consciousness. At the very least, you know, you had Schatz from Hawaii when he was talking about his debt-free college program.
Yep.
Putting aside the aspects of the policy itself, the interesting thing was that he came out and was like, "Yeah, I'm not telling you how we're paying for it. Doesn't matter. It's not important. I don't need to do that."
And that's what we learned from the GI Bill.
Right.
You know, my dad, my wife's dad, both went to college on the GI Bill. My dad dropped out after 2 years because mom got pregnant with me and went to work in a tool and die shop. But her dad finished law school and became the assistant attorney general of the state of Michigan. And what they found was that for every dollar invested in those young people coming back from World War II, we got, as a nation, an additional $7 more than we would have gotten in taxes from them. Because they had higher incomes than they would have otherwise had over their lifetimes.
Right.
So every dollar we invested, we got $7 back as a country. It's an investment.
Well, yeah, I'm not even talking about the policy, but as much as he presented it without providing like how I'm going to pay for it.
Right. And well, that's why there's no need for it, because it will pay for itself. And that's why every other developed country in the world offers free college to their people.
But politically, it's encouraging that Democrats don't feel like there's some evidence that some Democrats don't feel like they have to present how I'm going to pay for this in any way.
The last Democrat to buy into that was Clinton in a big way.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, maybe to a certain extent, Obama as well.
Not
as explicitly, but it was...
He did not have control of policy after the first year and a half.
Right.
I mean, he had, you know...
That $700 trillion stimulus, which was half a billion, which was half tax cuts.
Right.
It was the same mentality. I can't do $1 trillion because that'll be, people will say $1 trillion.
Well, he just couldn't get it through Congress.
Do you think that was the case? Or do you think they started off at $700 billion, they ended up at $700 billion?
No, I thought they started out at well over $1 trillion.
Oh, I
might be wrong on that.
They never entered into negotiations at that time that way.
But Obama had this terrible habit of saying, here's what I want. And the Republicans would say, fine, you get half of it. Instead of saying, here's twice what I want, but I'm not telling you it's twice.
Right. He didn't negotiate.
Lousy negotiator.
Tom, thank you so much. It's so fascinating to talk to you. I really
appreciate
it.
It's always a pleasure, Sam. And an honor.
We should hopefully we'll do it again. And folks, you can check out Tom's show.
TomHartmann.com.
As a VOD, because of course it's on at noon. Yep. So every day. People have to watch my show live, and then they can watch yours on demand.
Oh, we're on YouTube. We're all over the place.
There you go. Tom, and thanks again. I really appreciate
it. Thanks,
Sam. You there, Sam? Oh.
Yeah, here I am.
Hey, Sam.
We're just firing up the...
You're calling into the phone lines? Is that what you're doing?
No, I was just firing up the Skype.
Oh, okay. There you go.
And so Tom Hartmann, folks, always, like I said yesterday, and you just heard, always a pleasure to catch up with Tom. I am anticipating at any moment a guest to come and talk about a pharmaceutical case.
Really? Because I've noticed at these conferences that pharmaceutical companies are actually sort of unusually ethical.
Yes. I did... You know, yesterday I recorded some interviews for Ring of Fire Radio, which, of course, is a show where we do shorter interviews. And a couple of cases were really fascinating. I'm going to play one, and if she doesn't show up soon, I'm going to play it very soon. But from that human rights trial lawyer, essentially, who litigates on behalf of victims of terrorism and ethnic cleansing and weapons manufacturers. Really interesting story. But so much news going on. It'll give us a chance just to touch on this. I don't know if we'll have time to... Yeah, we could play a clip as well. But before we get to that, this... it's quite clear, and I guess now it's just breaking... that Rod Rosenstein is preparing to be fired.
Okay.
And so it's all starting to...
It's happening.
And it's happening.
Yeah.
The talk of them pardoning Scooter Libby. There is no... And this is coming via Marcy Wheeler, who I trust on this, and certainly in the context of the Scooter Libby trial, there's no one who knows more about that situation than Marcy Wheeler. She... reported on it at the time, and her coverage of it was really unparalleled. But pardoning Scooter Libby is completely a symbolic gesture. He gets no material benefits from it at this point because he's got all the material benefits he needs.
Because is it correct that so Bush didn't pardon but commuted his sentence? Is that
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Got it.
But he's been reinstated by the bar.
Right.
And so according to her, it is completely symbolic. And why would you do this unless you are prepared to pardon other people, right? I would anticipate that not only will he pardon Scooter Libby, he will ask, you know, somebody will come up with the idea of like, you should pardon somebody who's in for drug charges, too. Just some random, guy.
Maybe not random. Maybe like, well, why not? I have friends from the Gambino family.
Right. Can I do those guys?
Could I do those guys?
Maybe I could get a kickback.
Could I do Pauly Cincione? He was a great guy.
But so we have this Scooter Libby situation. Rod Rosenstein perhaps on the verge of being fired. There, Devin Nunes has... a day or two ago, I guess, announced that he is contemplating holding Rod Rosenstein and I think it's McCabe in contempt of Congress for documents that he's requested that the FBI is not forwarding. So they're setting up the premise, and it really is sort of kabuki, I guess. It's really just so that Fox has something to talk about. They're setting up the premise for firing these guys, and then I guess ostensibly to fire Mueller. There was a story out by Charlie Savage yesterday that indicated Mueller has not shared as much as people maybe have speculated with the New York AG's office. And people should be clear about this. When they referred the the warrant in the case of Michael Cohen to the Southern District of New York office. That is a federal, that's a U.S. attorney. It is not New York State jurisdiction. So with that said, the idea of them sharing that information after the fact seems to be plausible and possible. So I guess that would be the way that they would indicate to Michael Cohen and perhaps Manafort, a pardon from the president will not necessarily suffice in this instance. So I know that's what's happening there.
And is this where it really just becomes, I guess, I like to just underline that regardless of how people come down on all the Russia stuff and blah, 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 that we've sort of talked about endless times, that when you get into this part of it, where it's just like the next level of destroying institutions, basically, you should be interested regardless of what you think of the initial investigation or story.
Yes, indeed. And look, when we've said from the very beginning that this is probably more about money laundering and using criminals to do favors or, you know, work for them and not realizing who it is that they're actually dealing with.
Right.
And we'll know more. But it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, I don't know what kind of reaction there's going to be if he fires Mueller. I don't anticipate the Republicans doing anything.
You'll see a few furrowed brows, but nothing, right?
I guess it's going to be more interesting to see if people actually take to the streets as people are calling for. So,
I mean, if anything, Republicans are talking about impeachment to drive up their voters in the midterms. Impeach. We'll protect. Democrats want to get out and vote for us to stop impeachment.
Yeah, I mean, right. I think that was the point that Cenk was making yesterday, right? And I'm not sure I buy into that.
That Republicans are campaigning on saying that Democrats want to impeach Trump, so you got to vote for us to block it from happening? I think they're doing that a bit.
No, maybe I didn't have this conversation with Cenk. Maybe I just had a drink. But there was a theory that I think it was that Cenk was talking about that the Republicans after their primaries.
Not my theory. No. I don't agree that.
Yeah. I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah.
That would work, and that they would think that way. I think they want to be protected by their own people at all times. So. All right. Well, I guess one of the problems with Vegas and anticipating guests coming is that this is the one time when lawyers maybe get to have some fun. And then they wake up the next morning and they're too sick to get out of bed.
Mm.
So let's play the interview I did with Gavi Marone. He is a human rights attorney. And I've interviewed him in the past about his work on following the money that ends up supporting terrorists or terrorist organizations, groups like ISIS, that is always facilitated by banks and or large corporations like, more often than not, oil companies. In this instance, he is just filed suit on behalf of victims of Saddam Hussein's chemical warfare. Really interesting story. And so, Matt, are you ready with that?
Yep.
All right, let's play that now. I'm with Gavi Marone, who is an international human rights attorney, and you specialize in tracking financing of terrorist activities, and you have now filed a suit against a company that was involved in providing Saddam Hussein with the material support to essentially commit an act of genocide against the Kurds in the north through chemical warfare, and to some extent Iran in the context of the Iranian, Iraq-Iran war. So, all right, tell us who are the defendants in this case?
Okay, so we've actually alleged that seven European companies and 15 individuals conspired with the Saddam regime to commit genocide. It's a heavy allegation, and it's more than just providing material support. The company, the primary defendant, is the largest tourism company in the world, which in those days was a huge West German conglomerate called Prusag, which changed its name to TUI, T-U-I. And they were in the business of steel, of equipment manufacturing, and of chemicals. And TUI met with members of Iraqi military intelligence and agreed to take their chief lawyer, a guy named Salah Majid, who didn't speak a word of English, who happened to be married to a German woman, knew English, but he's an Iraqi lawyer, and they brought him to Hanover, Germany in 1980, and we've interviewed him and so on. He claims that he was hired to be the chief lawyer for international tenders for this giant conglomerate without speaking a word of German. And he worked there until the day that the Saddam regime was toppled and still doesn't speak German. And that he claimed that the reason he was given the job was because German lawyers don't know how to speak English. And he was, in fact, the mole, or the cover given to him by TUI to organize the entire weapons procurement program for Iraq clandestinely in Europe. He told us that he, even though he was the chief lawyer for tenders for TUI, he was allowed to work at the same time for TUI's competitors in helping them do tenders. So there's no question he was really working for Saddam Hussein. And they put together a plan with multiple companies to build the entire chemical weapons facilities in Iraq, which became the largest chemical weapon plants in the world during the Cold War in Iraq, during a time of sanctions also. And most of the companies that were major participants came from West Germany. So, for instance, we have copies of letters and emails that one West German company writes to another named Heuberger, and they say, okay, we've been contracted to build the, quote, pesticide, quote, factory, which we know is what they call devil's kitchen. And they labeled the buildings as bunkers because they were built underground. In fact, they built seven factories and labs, and then they built what they called seven dummy buildings above ground. This whole plant was outside of Samarra in the middle of the desert on a military base with machine guns on every building, tanks, and surface-to-air missiles surrounding the entire complex. Typical factory, right? And all the buildings were built underground with 1 meter thick reinforced concrete roofs and 2 meters of hardened clay above it to protect from air bombardment. The buildings were empty shells so that if someone tried to bomb the pesticide plants, they would hit the empty buildings. So the point here is there was absolutely no question they were building chemical weapons factories and not pesticide plants.
In fact, the initial plans were tendered to an American company, you told
Correct.
Me. So just tell that story as further evidence that there was it was unreasonable for this German conglomerate to not understand what they were doing.
Right, exactly correct. There's a company called Pufuder, it's hard to pronounce, it's P-F-U-D-E-R. And in 1975, the Saddam regime approached this company through the Ministry of Agriculture in Iraq, saying they want to build a pesticide plant. And so they sent two of their engineers out to Iraq to see the site, and they drew up blueprints of what a pesticide plant would normally look like. And then the Ministry of Agriculture requested some modifications and enlargements. when the management in America saw what the modifications were, they immediately washed their hands of the project and withdrew. Then, a year later, these plans appeared in a company in England called Imperial Enterprises, and with the same request to continue on with the specs and plans. And not only did they refuse, but they contacted a British intelligence, and that was reported in the Washington Post that this could be used for chemical weapons. Then Iraq stepped back, and they reorganized everything under the Ministry of Technology and Weapons, called SOTI. It was run by military intelligence. And all the contracting from this point on goes between these companies and military intelligence in Iraq.
But still, supposedly about agricultural products.
Right. So the code name for the project was Project 922, and they labeled it as pesticide plants. And there was over 100 German engineers during the years that were on site. Each one of the German companies that are defendants had offices in Baghdad. So they absolutely knew what it is. Military intelligence officials were constantly at their offices. And we have that from testimony and interviews, because in the 90s, some of these people were prosecuted in Germany for illegal export of weapons, without saying chemical weapons, but that was all they exported. They all testified, for instance, they were on the base, they never saw anything, they were only there on days that nothing was being produced, that they there was never one drop of pesticide ever produced in this base, in these plants. One of the things that they were requested to do is you would have air circulation in factories, especially where you're dealing with pesticide. And normally the standard was that you would replace the entire atmosphere of the factory, once every 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like
that. So the airflow is such that you have fresh air going through.
So they installed air handlers that every 30 seconds replaced the entire air, which is much, you're dealing with toxins that are totally not like pesticide.
Right.
They also built what they called in German an, quote, inhalation chamber. Cute. It was a gas chamber. This was to test the, quote, pesticide. And if you were thinking, okay, what are pests for pesticide, it would be like little tiny bugs or something like this. So how big of an inhalation gas chamber would you need? You can think about it, would fit on this table. It was 3 meters by 3 meters by 2 meters, large enough to fit donkeys. And we have evidence that they started out testing it with dogs, then donkeys, then Iranian prisoners of war were tested in it. And then they built a what they called an incinerator, which you can think of today's Holocaust Remembrance Day, you can think of the ovens in Auschwitz, to go ahead and incinerate the carcasses after they killed them in the gas chamber. And this is, again, a West German companies did this. So it's just astounding.
All right, Gavi Marone, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about who the plaintiffs are in this case. And just get a sense of time. And then ultimately, you know, what happened to these facilities? I mean, obviously, the arguments of the Iraq war were that the Saddam Hussein regime had weapons of mass destruction. We'll talk about that, and obviously they weren't made up from whole cloth, but the question was, did they still have them in 2003 when the United States invaded? All right, we're going to take a quick break. Continuing our coverage at the 2018 Mass Torts Conference, I'm here with Gavi Marone. He is an international human rights lawyer who much of his work, and we've talked in the past about your pursuit of terrorism financing through banks and corporations, most often than not oil companies. But you have filed a case against a German corporation that the claim is that they knowingly helped Saddam Hussein build facilities for chemical weapons that were used in genocide of Kurds in the north of Iraq, as well as during the Iran-Iraq war. So you told us in the last segment how clearly obvious it was that the German corporation had been contracted to build not a pesticide facility, but rather a chemical weapons facility. Who are the plaintiffs in this case?
So we have approximately 4,000 plaintiffs. 3,000 of them actually were killed by the weapons, the estates of 3,000 people, and roughly 1,000 surviving family members, many of which are injured. All of the injured are dying. They've lived horrible lives where they had 10 to 20% of their lung capacity. The rest, they were blinded by the mustard gas. It depends how serious they were injured by which gas, because cocktails were used of different gases on Halabja and 400 other villages across the Kurdish region. And if you were harmed by mustard gas is a blistering agent, which also destroys your lungs and blinds you, destroys your cataracts. But many times you could survive, but then whatever's left of your life is in pain every moment. Nerve gas kills you very rapidly, and two nerve gases were used, sarin and tabun. Sarin is the same nerve gas that the Assad regime used last week in Baghdad, in Damascus. If you survive the nerve gas, you actually recover. And so of the roughly 900 and something surviving family members, we still have 143, we had 144 2 weeks ago, who were mustard gas victims, and they're suffering horrible, painful lives. And the rest of them were nerve gas victims, or a few of them weren't there in the day of the attack. And so they've just lost, like, for instance, one client is the sole surviving son, and he lost 17 brothers, sisters, parents, and so on.
So, okay, so, and this is taking place during, essentially from 83 to 89, I believe?
The plants were started to be built in 81. Starting in 83, it was documented by the United Nations Secretary General and UN reports every 6 months, that, and then numerous media reports, that Iraq was using chemical weapons on Iranian soldiers. They also did two giant massacres against the Kurds, not with chemical weapons, but they slaughtered thousands of Kurds in those massacres. In 1987, they started using chemical weapons against their own Kurds, I mean Iraqi citizens, through 88. Chemical weapons were a key in a genocide, a key component of a genocide in which 180,000 Kurds were killed. Mm. During this time. And what the Iraqi army did was, because the Kurds are in the mountains in all kinds of villages, as you saw how long it took to defeat ISIS, it would have taken them years to try to go village by village. What they wanted to do is to kill every living thing in a strip from one side to the other, the entire Kurdish region. And we've got copies of the orders, every living thing, all animals, plants, and humans. And so what they would do is they would surround an area with a number of villages with the army on the roads, and then they would bombard for 2 days with chemical weapons the villages. Everyone would flee into the waiting arms of the troops. Then they would be boarded. They would be taken on trucks and buses. Normally the men and the women were separated. By men, we mean 10-year-old boys until 70-year-old men. Those were all then machine gunned into trenches and killed in the desert. And the women were put into concentration camps and later what they were called resettlement villages. So they basically lived a life with no men. So during the first 7 months of the slaughter, that's how they did it. The last 2 months, they killed the women and girls and everybody.
So what happened to these facilities and to the what was manufactured there? By 2003, it was quite clear that there was no major caches of of this material. What happened to it?
So as part of the ceasefire in the first Gulf War in 91, Iraq committed, under UN supervision, with the United States had a big presence in, the destruction of all of its chemical weapons stockpiles and facilities and biological weapons, and if there was any nuclear. So for the next months, base by base, building by building, they were all destroyed, and the chemical weapons were all taken, and they were neutralized. And more or less, that was complete. And the Iraqi regime was required to report to the United Nations how it obtained all the materials and from whence, and a description, which is a good part of our evidence.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, I would imagine at that point, as it's being dismantled, the United Nations is logging, like, where did this stuff come from? What were the means in which it was made?
Exactly, and Iraq was required to disclose. They never disclose 100% of everything. So theoretically, all of the chemical weapons then were destroyed, and all of the chemical weapons plants destroyed. So we saw in Syria recently that supposedly all the chemical weapons were exported out of Syria, but then somehow they have some again. So prior to the Second Gulf War, I guess, the United States figured that there must be more chemical weapons, or they must have rebuilt them, or, you know, and that's what they publicly stated was the reason for that war. And we know that they never found any more weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, we have just about a minute and a half left. How is it that in 1992, let's say, around that time, the UN is logging this material and presumably with whatever type of machinery or technology, and, you know, it's not like this stuff is made in everybody's backyard. Pretty clear where, at least some sense, how is it this material has been sitting there for almost 40 years? Or I guess, 20 years, 25 years.
And no, the materials were all destroyed.
No, but I'm saying the information.
The documents.
Yes, the documents. We just have about a minute left. I mean, how is it that this is only happening now?
Who else? First of all, you're talking about poor people who are scattered amongst villages out in Kurdistan with no access to lawyers that would do something. So who went there? I mean, I happen to go there, and since 2005, I've been going to Iraq back and forth. I open offices there. This is a huge investment of time and money to do it. Who else reached out to them? So, and why did no one else do it? The only thing I can mention is that the trials of Saddam Hussein and Chemical Ali and all those after the liberation of Iraq, right? The law that set up the court to do it had a specific provision that you could only bring to trial individuals and not companies. Why that law said that?
Who set that law up?
Well,
the CPA?
The Iraqi government, but of course during the time that... So I mean, I don't know. I can just speculate. But from my perspective, what we have is, forgetting about the politics of it all, which I'm really not focused on,
right,
is that here we have corporate greed, willing to make money on the death and suffering of people, you know, and being with impunity and never once ever being held accountable. And that's what we're trying to change.
Gavi Marone, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Okay, I'm...
Oh. Yo. Sam.
Yeah, hey. Do you have a picture?
Do we have a picture? Just a sec.
Okay. All right, well, that was Gavi Marone. And just let me know if you got a picture now, Matt. Okay. With me now is Shannon Panic from Panic Law. And Shannon, you're from...
New York City.
Okay, great. And so... Mm-hmm. We'll be traveling back together tomorrow.
Yes.
Well, not necessarily together, but...
I hope to make it out today.
All right. So, Shannon, you are working on litigation involving proton pump?
Right.
What is that?
So, proton pump inhibitors, also commonly referred to as the little purple pill, Prilosec, Nexium, they are very effective acid inhibitors in our stomach lining, and they are prescribed and were supposed to be prescribed for very severe, you know, heartburn, essentially. Heartburn that was called, you know, GERD, gastric erosive, you know, disorder, something that could potentially lead to esophagitis, Barrett's, cancer of the esophagus. You know, that can happen in a few people, but so it was basically prescribed as candy.
So just to be clear, that is when you get some type of acid reflux or something,
right,
and that can deteriorate your digestive tract, particularly.
Yeah, your esophagus. Right.
Okay.
Your esophagus.
And all right. So, and people take it like candy. So, I mean, to be more, so just walk us through this. When was it developed? What was, what is the, I guess, why is the company that manufactured this responsible for how people take it now?
Right. Okay. So there is a large market for antacid products, right? There was the development of Tums, and then there was the development of H2 inhibitors, which is kind of a similar product, but not as powerful as the PPI products, the proton pump inhibitors. And AstraZeneca.
Let me just stop you before. What is why proton pump? What is that specifically?
Okay, that is the pump in our stomach lining that is actually responsible for creating the acid which digests our food.
Okay.
Some of us over-create acid, and maybe our lining is different. Maybe our stomachs are bigger or smaller, and physiologically we get more acid buildup, and then we experience heartburn.
Okay.
Or maybe you have really poor diets, too.
Okay.
And stress.
All right, and so there, this is part of a this particular drug. It was a part of a class of drugs, and you were saying
that's correct. PPIs.
PPIs.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were saying how the company is who manufactures this. Now, is your suit involving all of these or
yes.
a specific? Okay.
Yes, this is a massive. In fact, this is the most prescribed medication and. In the entire history of the United States, probably, PPIs as a class. So it started out in 1989 with Astra, which is now AstraZeneca, finding and patenting what became Prilosec. It came on the market. So PPIs have been on the market for quite a long time. And it was such a lucrative market that you had almost every major manufacturer involved with pharmaceuticals jump on kind of in a Me Too fashion to develop very similar classes of drugs, sometimes almost identical drugs, like another, you know, literally just using one particular molecule and calling, you know, Prilosec, half of Prilosec a new drug.
Is that how you can, I mean, can you get away with that in terms of a new patent, or is it, what's involved in that?
Right. So it's kind of a weird trick with inorganic chemistry. So you take the original Prilosec molecule, and there are two mirror images of that molecule together. One is an active form, and one is an inactive form. They were able to isolate the active form of Prilosec, and it's just the enantiomer of it. And what they basically did is they cut Prilosec in half, and they doubled the dosage, and they called it a new drug. So it is arguably, I mean, they allowed it. They were allowed to get a patent. The FDA allowed it to go to market, but it really did change the nature of how manufacturers are able to essentially extend kind of a patent on a drug by cutting a drug in half, increasing the dosage and calling it a new drug.
And so are the plaintiffs in this case a series of different pharmaceutical companies, or is it
the defendants include
defendants,
right? The defendants include AstraZeneca, Merck, which was a co-promoter, they were involved with the co-creation of the Prilosec model. We have Takeda, we have Abbott, Wyeth, Pfizer, a whole slew, even Procter & Gamble, which sells, you know, never was really involved in pharmaceuticals, got on the bandwagon when Prilosec was allowed to go over the counter.
Okay, and so those are the defendants. Who are the plaintiffs?
The plaintiffs are thousands of Americans all over this country who have taken this drug for a long time, and what we now know, and as a result of very strong epidemiology studies that have come out, is that the long-term use of these drugs causes chronic kidney disease. Now, not so long-term use causes something called acute interstitial nephritis, which will hospitalize you, which will and then leave you with chronic kidney disease. It's very severe, and so we have an entire, you know, thousands of people that have developed chronic kidney disease, and chronic kidney disease, unfortunately, oftentimes can progress to end-stage renal disease and eventually death.
So what is it that you what do you need to prove, I guess, and what is the claim, I guess, that you're also
certainly
okay.
So I think you know, from a general causation, what we call as lawyers, we need to prove the science showing that these drugs actually cause these injuries, these two particular injuries. And the science is extremely strong. As I mentioned, there's been several epidemiology studies that have come out from very reputable institutions, one from Yale, another that was published in the British Medical Journal, showing, you know, in controlled epidemiology studies, you know, when you're controlling for other risk factors, that there's absolutely an increased risk of chronic kidney disease and acute interstitial nephritis. So that's one aspect of it. Then we also want to prove, well, how is it that PPI actually does this? I mean, sometimes we don't actually have to prove that in court, but it certainly helps if we're able to point to a biological mechanism.
So that's part of the evidence of causation.
Right, exactly. And we have isolated a couple of different of biological mechanisms that have become very evident, and which were honestly evident in the preclinical animal studies that were being done back in the 90s. By these companies.
Okay, so is that the next part that you need to prove? Is that one, there's a relationship, there's a causal relationship between this kidney disease and the extended use, or even like, I guess, midterm use of this drug. And then you need to prove that these companies either knew or should have known that there was this relationship?
Absolutely. Great point. That's definitely something that we have to face, because a lot of companies could be like, whoa, we had no idea, you know? But they're not going to be able to do that in this case, because the animal studies that they had back in the 1990s show rats that were given PPI as little as 3 months were developing interstitial nephritis, very similar to acute interstitial nephritis,
right,
and we're not recovering, which is the same thing that we're seeing today in people. And so the science is very strong here.
How do you where is it that you find the records of those of those experiments?
They're actually, a lot of them have been produced to us already. We're in the process of doing discovery against the defendants and taking what is known as 30B6 depositions of the corporate witnesses. So, for instance, I was in Stockholm taking depositions of the people that were are now responsible for the preclinical studies that AstraZeneca does, and also for Takeda.
So you have those the studies which showed that there was reason to believe at least there's a problem in rats. Is there other evidence that indicates that they knew?
Right.
And then you also...
Absolutely.
Well, tell us about that evidence before we move on to the sort of...
Sure, absolutely. So we know that, you know, regardless of these animal studies, which I think that the companies really turned a blind eye to, I mean, they knew going into it. George Sachs, the inventor of PPI, when he approached AstraZeneca or Astra at the time, he knew at the time that this was going to be a billion-dollar drug. And it actually turned out to be much more than that. So there was a lot of impetus, I think, probably to just, let's ignore the rats with renal problems. Rats always get renal problems. Dogs, they probably get renal problems too. They're not humans. So there was kind of turning that eye to it. And then you have to realize that something like chronic kidney disease is a long-term disease that comes up, right? It's in most clinical trials that were done in people, we're talking maybe a max a year. And there were numerous clinical trials that were done, right? But you're not going to see in those clinical trials what has been borne out through the decades of usage now in market.
So you shorten the time frame, and you necessarily eliminate a whole host of ailments that could show up.
Absolutely.
Because they're not acute.
Right.
Okay. And so do you need to show that they operated, well, obviously, was it their duty to report the results of those tests to the FDA? What were their obligations in terms of warning the consumers?
Right. So they absolutely had a duty to report these to the FDA. And in all regards, what I've seen is that these animal studies, which, you know, are literally thousands of pages long, they were submitted to the FDA. And the FDA receives these submissions. They are, you know, about, you know, a foot deep in terms of a submission, and they were submitted. But then they had a further duty, and they always have a duty, to further investigate when they see a warning sign and to be on the lookout and to further test, and then also to warn people. There's still not a warning today, despite the incredible science that's been developed. There's still not a warning for chronic kidney disease.
And so what are the instructions? Because I noticed in reading some of the research that Larry the Cable Guy comes
right.
up in this. Tell us about that. I mean, it's
right.
not just because, it's not just a critique of his comedy.
Sure, sure. He was instrumental, I would say, to the Prilosec OTC brand and to the entire OT switch that was done with going from being a prescription drug to over-the-counter. And if you read the label, it says you're only supposed to take it for 14 days. All right, that's a very short time period.
Now, why do they put that on the label? Is that indication that they know there's a problem if you have extended use?
I certainly think so, because they want you to stop taking it 14 days so you can go back and see your physician so that you are under a constant care. But it's not just because of the maybe kidney injuries, but there's a whole slew of other bad things that happen when you take this drug, including osteoporosis, bone fractures, hypomagnesemia, which we think is a biological mechanism for chronic kidney disease. So they want you to go back and see a doctor. But then Larry the Cable Guy, who, you know, is riding around on his jet ski and going through rings of fire, you know, he says, and I take it every single day for my frequent heartburn. So it was a very misleading marketing campaign. And, you know, it just, I guarantee you, you know, that's going to come home to haunt them eventually.
Because their marketing is contrary to
right.
what they are putting on the label. And
exactly.
they clearly knew that there is potential for some problems.
Right.
Otherwise, they would say, take it every day.
And they're very careful, of course, with those words. You know, my frequent severe heartburn, I'm sure, went through so many vetting processes as to, well, what does that mean? And you know, because 70%... Oh, go ahead.
You could reinterpret frequent, you could reinterpret severe,
right.
and so
right.
their response would be, well, this person had it every
yeah.
day,
mm-hmm.
but frequent really means three times a day.
Right.
And severe means...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so when a drug goes from prescription to over-the-counter, mm-hmm. Is there a requirement by the drug maker to indicate to the FDA that it's safer than a prescription drug? I mean, mm-hmm. how do you, what is that process, and is that in any way implicated in this?
Right, suit? Absolutely. I think that's going to be a big part of this litigation. Is you were, basically what happened is AstraZeneca petitioned the FDA to make this one of the kind of the first times when we saw a prescription drug go over the counter. Their big argument was, well, it's been on the market for so long and we really haven't seen anything happen with it, and there's tons of people that take it. And then they handed it to Procter & Gamble to do the marketing, Larry the Cable Guy. And I mean, there was a huge launch. There were, you know, I think 1,000 purple trucks that were sent out on the day that they were allowed to sell and stock the shelves of America with Prilosec OTC. And it was, all the focus was on the marketing and getting that drug out, as opposed to making meaningful warnings or continuing to meaningfully test and examine the kidney issues here.
Are there FDA requirements?
Oh, of course, there are FDA requirements, but the same requirements, you know, regarding the labels, they all, you know, it's still the manufacturer's duty to be updating their label once they have knowledge of information of a potential risk. And they never fulfilled that obligation. I mean, the growing evidence, at the same time that they're sending out these thousands of trucks to fill the, you know, Walgreens and the Walmarts of the world, there was an article in 2006 by a very respected scientist who said, you know, the entire class of PPIs has been implicated in causing kidney disease. There must be a stop to the overprescription of these drugs.
where did that, I mean, that piece that you just cited, was there sort of independent studies that were being done?
Yes, these are independent nephrologists and epidemiological nephrologists. This was by a particular scientist by the last name of Givasinga. And these are in, you know, very well-known, well-circulated medical journals that went directly to the company, that the company read. The company even had a duty to put the FDA on notice about that, and we're not even sure that they passed that article on to the FDA.
Do you know if there was other evidence that the company had that there was this causal connection? Were there other, did they other studies? Are they getting calls from doctors who are saying, hey, is renal failure implicated?
Yes.
Was that happening?
Starting in the 1990s, doctors started collecting cases of these very severe kidney injuries, where people were showing up, they were being hospitalized, they were going into complete renal failure, and the doctor's like, well, what are these people on? They're not drug users, they're not on nephrotoxins. The only culpable agent was that they were on Prilosec or Nexium. I mean, these case reports started repleting the literature starting in the early 1990s. You know, of course, I mean, that goes out to, you know, a handful of scientists and people that are reading the literature, and never makes it to the consumer or actually the frontline prescriber a lot of times. You know, those are things that the, you know, so there wasn't enough communication of that information to the prescribers either.
And who statutorily has that obligation to make sure that the doctors are aware of these things or the consumers? It's the manufacturer?
It changes a little bit when you've got direct-to-consumer marketing that you're doing. You know, there is definitely the argument that physicians have an obligation to treat their patients as they should and to do the best type of care and always be educating themselves and pass along any warnings. But it is the manufacturer's duty to make sure that the physicians are being appropriately detailed when their salesperson goes in and has all of the information in the product label. And as what we see actually is that 70% of the people that are taking PPI are on it for an indication, for something that is not indicated. You know, it's like, oh, you had a little too much barbecue, or you're a lawyer that's stressed out. You know, here's PPI. Maybe that'll help with your heartburn next time. And it's not even very effective when you just have a infrequent bout of, you know, indigestion or something like that.
It's only something when you have a systemic
problem.
Right.
This is for a very severe, you know, significant, frequent, you know, you're having it. You're supposed to be having frequent heartburn means you're supposed to be having it, you know, every day of the week, basically.
And even in that instance, this is only for temporary relief and you need
only
to...
Only 14 days. Yeah.
So what is the status of the case now? Do you have a figure about what the damages may be from
Absolutely.
Like this?
First of all, we have just really started the litigation in terms of being in a mass tort MDL, right? So
That
is the multi-district litigation. It's in the District of New Jersey. There is a plaintiff steering committee of numerous different law firms that are involved with, bringing an aggressive plan of discovery against these defendants. It's very unheard of to have this many major defendants in a pharmaceutical litigation. So this is going to
because
be a massive endeavor.
It's pretty rare that they all have the same drug. It just so happens that the molecular structure of this drug lent itself to being copied, essentially.
Right. Okay. And they couldn't help themselves. Everybody wanted a piece of action on this drug. And everyone got a piece of action on this drug. It is very significant.
Like, how many billions of dollars has the aggregate of these companies made?
Okay. $10 billion a year.
A year.
A year in annual sales. I mean, it's incredible. And it is... One of the things that we are going to face is very difficult to get off of these drugs, which is...
They're addictive.
They are absolutely addictive.
Okay, continue. I'm just going to put the video back on. So, so $10 billion a year. What are you seeking in terms of damages?
Well, you know, a lot of that will be determined on a case-by-case basis. Chronic kidney disease is nothing to joke around with. We spend in this country, I think, upwards of $20 billion a year helping the beneficiaries of government programs who have kidney disease.
So this, you're okay, talking this like is, dialysis?
Right, dialysis, like end-stage treatment, when someone dies, all of that. This is an expensive disease to live with. And now, once you have chronic kidney disease, once it gets to the end stage part, your only option is to have kidney transplant or to go, you know, three times a week, be hooked up to the dialysis, yeah, which is an awful, awful situation. And you will die without that. So
Do you have you figured a number? Is that what like the steering committee does?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's to be born. We are. It's hard to, you know, just put a number on it. And I think that we're at an early stage of getting an assessment of how many people are out there, and people are at a varying different degrees of illness. Too.
How did this case initiate? I mean, did you get a call one day from someone who said, you know, my doctor thinks that my kidney failure is a function of,
right,
I took one of these, you know,
right,
Larry the Cable Guy drugs?
I think it was really the strong epidemiology studies that came out. I mean, there were certainly people probably looking at it before the strong epi came out in 2016. But epidemiology is sort of the pinnacle of the scientific evidence that we can bring into court. It's very hard to refute a strong, well-conducted epi study. Before bringing on such a large litigation, you want to be sure,
right,
that, you know, you've got everything in a row. And so I would say really in 2016 was when the focus really started getting in front. But the PPIs have been under investigation and scrutiny for quite a while because they're just a bad drug. They cause a whole host of problems. I mean, they're associated with cardiovascular disease, dementia, and they absolutely cause bone fractures and osteoporosis. Like, so why are we prescribing this terrible drug anyways to people? And I think the medical community is getting very on board with the fact that this drug has been prescribed to way too many people.
Do you go, when you're talking to family and friends, is that like,
yeah,
the first thing you say to them is like, don't take any of these drugs?
Listen, I'm a lawyer, and there are too many lawyers on this drug, all right? I mean, there are so many lawyers that, you know, are having a difficult time getting off of it. But absolutely, my conversations with family and friends, this is not something I would want anybody in my family or that someone that I knew to be on. But it's very hard to get off of.
If you are one of those people who are on the drug, like, what do you do at this point?
Great question.
Renal failure, and you were like, I used to take that all the time.
So, great question. First of all, I would say that to anybody who is on this drug still, they need to go to their doctor. They need to have their, what is called their GFR levels checked. That will be a metric of their kidney function.
GFR stands for?
Glomerular filtration rate.
I see.
Glomerular filtration rate.
And there's
it's how good your kidneys work, basically,
yeah,
cleaning you.
I went through a situation with a family member who there is also a specific level of some substance, I can't remember.
Creatinine's another marker.
If there's more creatinine, mm-hmm, that means that your kidney is not functioning,
right,
properly, and you got to, mm-hmm, get down to like 3.5 as opposed to some elevated level.
Right, and there are a few other metrics as well that can be used. It's very easy to be tested
first
and
thing
to assess
is,
for.
Go to your doctor and make sure that you're not suffering any type of diminishment in your,
mm-hmm,
kidney function.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens after that?
Have a discussion about, you know, well, am I a person that really needs to be on it? And if I'm not a person that maybe is it, so there are certain people that it might be an appropriate treatment for because they just have recalcitrant GERD, and they also already have what is known as Barrett's esophagus. So Barrett's esophagus is when your esophagus is eroded so greatly that you're now at risk for having esophageal cancer. That's that's a big risk.
Right.
You don't want to take that risk. So that's maybe worth taking the PPI, but that's a very limited amount of people. So you want to have a discussion about, okay, so are there other alternatives? There are other alternatives out there. I unfortunately have talked to so many people who are, you know, they are in chronic kidney disease. They are in chronic renal failure, and they cannot get off of the drugs because it permanently changes the lining of your stomach. And let me just give you a very big illustration of this. There was a very well done study where they put people on PPI that were healthy, people without GERD, people without heartburn. They gave them PPI for 28 days. They took them off, and these people had heartburn and they had GERD because there's something called hyper rebound acid that occurs. So you shut down all the proton pumps, and then when you turn them back on,
they go full
blast. Boom. Yeah, it's just crazy.
Wow. All right. Well, Shannon Penick, it is a Penick Law. And if I'm one of those people who go and I see my doctor and the doctor says, yeah, you have some kidney damage here. Fortunately, it is, you know, you're at 80%, 85% of kidney function, which is, you just got to monitor that, but that's okay. What do they do then? If they, do people contact you at that point or
Absolutely.
Contact the law firms to get part of the,
okay. Absolutely. I mean, there's several law firms across the, several great law firms that I'm working with, that are taking these cases, that we're investigating them and helping people talk about these issues. So absolutely.
Shannon Penick, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah,
really
wonderful.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks. We got a little more time. We'll go through some sound here. And
do you want to take some calls?
Let's... I've got some time. We can maybe take one or two calls.
Okay.
In the meantime, let's hit some of this sound, because this is...
Do I look like the kind of guy that needs to listen to sound?
Yeah, I think we got to play this. This is too crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So, obviously, James Comey is hitting the book circuit. And, again, this bears repeating. I appreciate James Comey telling us these funny stories. I appreciate the fact that James Comey was investigating enough so that Donald Trump fired him. James Comey is not your friend. James Comey, I think, you know, obviously, it's no secret that I feel that Hillary Clinton made many mistakes on her campaign. But aside from, if there's any externality that is implicated in Hillary Clinton's loss, that is not Donald Trump or the voters, it would be James Comey. And
apparently,
I think people remember,
he acknowledges some of that in the book.
Yes, and yeah. And not to toot my own horn, but
yeah, he acknowledges your reason. Yeah.
Well, he didn't decide it as my reason, but
he did. He said Jew
Ronald
and
Reagan
former on Sex and the City actor was right.
Ronald Reagan on Twitter reminded me that, and I guess someone pulled up the videos back in February of last year of 2017, where I speculated that Comey may have just thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win, that it was unquestionable that she was going to win. And that because Donald Trump had already talked about prosecuting her, and that he was specifically, and he may at that time, obviously, you know, when he talked about Clinton, he was fully aware that there was a serious investigation into Donald Trump. My speculation was that he felt like he needed to make sure that she was, that there was no question about the validity of her election, or that there was no question about the integrity of the investigation into her, so that her presidency would not be tainted. That didn't quite work out. And apparently he said he wrote something like
that. A little
bit
of a miscalculation there.
Missed it by that much. but here is, with all that said about James Comey as to why he is not someone you should be.
And not for nothing, he's a fucking cop. Like, he's not our friend. He's not. The FBI is not a progressive force in the world.
That is true. That is absolutely
true. I have a totally different opinion of that.
But here is James Comey on with George Stephanopoulos talking about the time that James Comey had to tell Donald Trump that there are reports that there is a pee tape.
This information.
How graphic did you get?
I think as graphic as I needed to be. I started to tell him about the allegation was that he had been involved with prostitutes in a hotel in Moscow in 2013 during a visit for the Miss Universe pageant, and that the Russians had filmed the episode. And he interrupted very defensively and started talking about it. You know, do I look like a guy who needs hookers? And I assumed he was asking that rhetorically. I didn't answer that, and then I just moved on and explained, sir, I'm not saying that we credit this, I'm not saying we believe it. We just thought it very important that you know.
Did you tell him you thought it wasn't true, or you didn't know if it was true or not?
I never said I don't believe it, because I couldn't say one way or another.
How weird was that briefing?
Really weird. It was almost an out-of-body experience for me. I was floating above myself, looking down, saying, you're sitting here briefing the incoming president of the United States about prostitutes in Moscow.
Now, James, honestly, tell me, don't you think I'm like at least a 7?
You would say, oh, a 7. Kidding me? 7. I'm a 9 at best. At worst, it's like, you know what is really amazing?
Not only is he, I don't know if he's the type of guy who would see prostitutes or, you know, whatever, however you phrase it. Needs prostitutes. I do feel like he's the type of guy that a good representative of a prostitute would say, take a pass on this one.
No, I think he's the type of guy that the prostitute, that the type, it's like literally a double negative, like pay double for me to touch you.
Right, exactly. Like, oh, like you're going to get
the quintessential guy, like, yeah, you know that normal, like, well, I don't know, $1,000 an hour rate? That's 2 for you.
Right, we're giving you the RNC convention has come to town rate.
Yeah. oh, I see. She wants to. You know why she did that? And he still wouldn't get it. He'd be like, oh, she wants to do a deal with me. She wants to negotiate, learn how to negotiate for me because I'm such a good negotiator.
That's unbelievable.
Just do a deal.
He also seems like the kind of guy you wouldn't even have to have sex with very long, if at all.
Right. I think, well, it could be just like, am I the type of guy who would pay to have sex with prostitutes as opposed to have them just pee on me? Who knows? But
he's a virgin.
Yeah, wow. Now buying in some more buy into my original theory. I like this. That Trump has never had sex.
His sexuality is completely outward facing.
If you listen to how Trump talks.
He just wants to seem like a playboy. He's never had sex.
Have you ever watched 40-Year-Old Virgin?
No, but wait a second. Don't we know from Stormy Daniels that they had sex?
I mean, I'm being a bit hyperbolic. I'm sure he's had sex once or twice, but like not that much.
Stormy, I'm in you. Now
Stormy,
it's done.
Stormy, you're my first time.
Stormy, oh my God, it's everything that I always pretended it was on Howard.
It's mostly like coffee. It's something I can brag about later.
Like the main thing is getting to brag about it to other guys.
I haven't been able to get an erection since I was 12, but when you spanked me and I said you reminded me of my daughter, it finally happened. Oh my God. That was the most transcendent 30 seconds of my life.
Perfect
right,
Wyatt.
Well, this is... We're really going the full high-low gamut on today's show. But, I mean, it's not... What are you going to do?
What else are you going to... You know what I also...
Casual Friday, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, dude. It's casual Friday.
Gotta be a little casual after all those interviews.
Yeah.
Jamie, I'll tell you something. I leave the office, and you're just like... You start swearing like a sailor.
Oh, I guess I started.
I really like those... Who's the? Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm feeling very casual today.
Yeah, it's
you know
very
what
casual.
I, you know
I'm
what's
wearing colors for the first time like in a while. It's made me very bold.
You know what's amazing about Trump, though, is that he really does. Like, we've stipulated all the things we have to. I always would mention the Muslim entrapment cases with Comey, obviously, but like,
he really does have an uncanny ability from everybody from Tillerson to Comey to just be like, well, I guess this is there is another dividing line, which is like right. Donald Trump versus any sort of quasi-sentient normal human being.
Right.
And then you just automatically relate to other people in conversation relative to him because Comey's like, right. Yeah, that was weird. It was like staring into the void.
Yeah, that's why Comey's been spending like 4 months with Reinhold Niebuhr.
It's like, I need to quit and read theology after 1 hour meeting with this guy.
But the I don't know, there was portions of this book that maybe we'll get to more on Monday as they get more released. But there was one where I read where Comey, you know, was almost brought to tears because Barack Obama said, I think you're a man of integrity. Something to that effect. God. Like, I just.
That's nauseating.
I mean, these guys, there's like a certain amount of cosplay involved in this, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, it totally is cosplay.
I mean, on one level, like, look. He screwed up in a big, big way by breaking policy, DOJ policy, and in releasing that letter about Clinton. And I guess, you know, I don't want to be too cynical about somebody who, at the very least, thought they were doing the right thing, because I suspect that in a lot of circles around the White House now, there are people who are just consciously aware of, like, I'm not doing the right thing, but I'm going to make some money off it. Yeah. So,
but probably be unemployable. You, Obama, like, but, hey, you messed up, but, you know, you definitely put that Chechen kid with Down syndrome in jail, so you're a man of integrity, James.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Well, yeah, well, I'm not going to judge you based upon the actual work you've done, just on the way that you come to me as a man and look me in the eye. Speaking of a White House full of people running around, probably aware that they're not doing the right thing, but they are lining their pockets. Here is Donald Trump. He was in the Rose Garden, and I don't know who they had in the audience. Like, they just brought in people, probably people who work in the administration, to come and clap for him. And even they seem to be, like, only capable of doing it in an anemic fashion. I mean, there's a quality to this that is really, banana republic stuff.
You're talking here, like we're at finally full Azerbaijani level now?
I mean,
like,
yes.
Get the janitorial staff out there to clap
the
for
staff
me.
Out to clap
now.
Me.
Please clap.
I need a pick me up here.
Yep.
And so here is Donald Trump, I guess, giving a speech to his staff, as if they're not his staff.
Things, and frankly, we fought very hard. We've taken care of our military for the first time in many, many years. $700 billion. We're going to have the strongest military that we've ever had. And can you think of a better time to have it, right? This is when we need it. We're going to have it. $700 billion, and next year, $716 billion. Also in that bill, $6 billion for opioid and helping us out with that horrible, horrible problem.
Opioid.
The fact is, we don't care about the donors and the special interests. We only care about you and your family and really making America great again. That's what we care about. That's why we're here. From the day I took the oath of office, I've been fighting to drain the swamp. And sometimes it may not look like it, but believe me, we are draining the swamp. And there are a lot of unhappy people. You can see that every day. All you have to do is turn on the news. Every time you see me hit, you know that I'm draining the swamp. And people don't like it. But we're also defending the American worker. We're making incredible trade deals.
Oh, my God.
You know what's really disturbing about that is I kind of feel
everything?
Like if you actually, yeah, everything. But if we were going to do the role play again where his brain isn't totally soaked in mush, and then he's like, it may not look like it all the time, so I acknowledge that this process looks very questionable, but were doing it, and every time you see people upset, now who are people, women, people of color, were draining the swamp, people from Haiti, like, you could whole read the whole thing as just, like, subtextual, like, we're doing it. It's white supremacy. It's happening.
It's happening.
And people are upset.
It's also funny how drain the swamp is like one of the main takeaways from the Cambridge Analytica thing. And it's like, and it's also something he said he wasn't hot on to begin with. But because it's been so successful, it's one of the few things he's still leaning in on.
That was great. Right, he did exactly. That in his speech. He was just like, yeah, I thought it was pretty stupid. But then you idiots clapped for it. And I was like, all right.
I'll do it. Whatever.
Well, he's still coasting on the idea that he's pissing off the right people, right? He's triggering the libs, the coastal elites, this sense of aggrievement against this, you know, vague class of people. And as long as they're angry, it means he's doing something right. But that doesn't follow.
Wait, do we have
the Elizabeth enemy Warren of your sound? Enemy is not but necessarily your friend.
Well, I think that's exactly right. But it does work for conservatives. I mean, that is been the pissing off those people has been an animating principle for conservatives for a long time. And the only other thing I think that is interesting is that I think they must have a sense that the budget was problematic with some of their conservative base.
Yeah.
You know, Bob Corker just came out and did the, like, it was the biggest mistake I've ever made voting for that.
I hate that guy.
Which is just like, give me a break.
He's such a scumbag.
But, it is indicative, I think, of some pushback on Trump. I mean, we saw this, you know, I just the idea that we have to cite this is just sort of absurd. But we saw Alex Jones do that sort of sarcastic, like, I'm no longer, you know, with Trump anymore because he signed the budget bill. They know that that is a liability for their, if not the base, at least the institutional base of the Republican Party, those people who may activate the base, they're caught up in it. And I suspect maybe there's some talk radio hosts who are complaining about it as well. And that is, there's a certain amount of defensiveness about that with Trump. I mean, now what he's got to be doing is to make sure that his base is activated, because when he goes into this mode where he fires Mueller, when he goes into this mode where he fires Rosenstein, when he, you know, pardons or attempts to pardon maybe Manafort or Cohen, he's going to need to have his base firmly behind him. And so I think that's what we're starting to see, you know, preparation for that.
We should play the Elizabeth Warren, Mick Mulvaney thing, because she actually basically calls Mulvaney out on the same dynamic and is basically like, you know, you're gutting consumer protections for the finance industry, and you're basically just bragging that it'll piss me off personally.
Yeah, let's play this clip with Elizabeth Warren. Now, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, just to remind people, was an idea of Elizabeth Warren's years and years ago. During the early aughts, she was a professor at Harvard who was writing extensively about bankruptcy. And like literally she was like a guest poster, a talking points memo, that type of thing. And she ultimately was tapped to form the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She could not get through Senate confirmation or was not put up because there was some clear, concern that she would be too effective at her job, frankly. So Rob Corddry ended up being the head of the CFPB. Elizabeth Warren went on to run for Senate in Massachusetts. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is literally her baby. And since Mick Mulvaney has taken over, there has been not a single enforcement action by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I mean, it's just sort of shocking. And here she is questioning Mick Mulvaney at a Senate Banking Committee hearing yesterday on Thursday.
Never supported the consumer watchdog, Mr. Mulvaney. You got to Congress after the CFPB was created. But in 2012, you voted in favor of a Republican budget that called for eliminating the agency entirely. Is that right?
I don't have a specific recollection, but that sounds familiar to me.
Sounds
yes, ma'am.
Familiar. Okay. But that was only the beginning. You also voted for Republican budgets that eliminated the CFPB in 2013, 2014, and 2015. Does that sound right?
Again, yes, ma'am. There were occasional Republican budgets I didn't vote for, and I don't know what was in them. But generally speaking, I see your point. Yes, ma'am.
All right. And in 2015, you also supported a standalone bill that would have killed off the CFPB. Is that right?
That's correct. I think I was a co-sponsor of that.
Okay. So I want to take a look at what would have happened if you had gotten your wish and the CFPB had been abolished as early as 2012. In 2017, the CFPB shut down a company called Top Notch Funding, which was scamming 9/11 first responders out of the taxpayer money they got to treat medical problems developed after 9/11. Mr. Mulvaney, if the CFPB had been abolished like you wanted, Top Notch Funding might still be out there stealing from 9/11 first responders, right?
They might be, or the FTC might have enforced the law.
Or some other agency might magically have intervened when they didn't.
Why would it be more magic to have the FTC do it than the Bureau?
They have a history of not doing this. You know, in Congress, you repeatedly tried to kill the consumer agency. Since you got to the agency, you have announced that you won't use the exact enforcement tool that CFPB used to stop every single scam that I've mentioned today. You've taken obvious joy in talking about how the agency will help banks a lot more than it will help consumers, and how upset this must make me. But here's what you don't get, Mr. Mulvaney. This isn't about me. This is about active duty military. It's about first responders and students and seniors and families, and Ari and his dad and millions of other people who need someone on their side when consumers get cheated. You are hurting real people to score cheap political points. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, you know, for what it's worth, there it is. And Mulvaney's, of course, not going to implement any of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's tools to hold people and companies and financial institutions accountable to the way that they rip off consumers. But at least it's on the record, as it were. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we should say, has been considered one of the best government agencies that's been created in decades, and has been was incredibly effective and saved hundreds of billions of dollars, my understanding, for consumers.
What does this guy even do all day? Like, seriously, like, Republicans are probably against no-show jobs, right? Like, this sounds kind of like that.
Well, first of all,
dismantling the entire agency,
yes,
meeting with
and
lobbyists.
I would argue that they're against no-show jobs. But
right.
If you want to get a sense of what it is that Mick Mulvaney, now that we've heard from Elizabeth Warren complaining that he's not doing anything positive, if you want to hear about what he's actually doing at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, here is Keith Ellison, who tweeted a picture of a newly frosted window at Mulvaney's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau office. He wrote, "Mick Mulvaney touts himself as Mr. Transparency, but today, when I showed him this picture, he admitted it was his office at CFPB and that he had the glass walls in the building frosted like this."
So he can take naps.
Yeah, exactly.
I would, if we're baselessly speculating about his behind the glass wall activities, I would say much more disturbing things than taking a nap.
God knows.
Whatever that evil little leprechaun is up to.
Put himself to sleep.
We're having executive time.
Yeah, up. Mick wants executive time.
It was just, I think it just broke that Trump has now pardoned Scooter Libby. That is, I just got that a brief. Can anybody confirm that for me? But I think, yes, He has pardoned Scooter Libby.
What a great name.
Now, there's As you know, Donald Trump gets most of his advice from Sean Hannity. However, to be fair, he also gets his advice from Fox and Friends in the morning. Hannity's at night. He likes to get his advice 24/7. Here is Fox and Friends. Is this from this morning? And
yep.
There's an interview that that Earhart. Ainsley Earhart?
Yep.
Is interviewing Geraldo, and this is just after Geraldo. Didn't he just have like some situation where he had an argument with Bill Maher? I think somebody sent me that clip where Geraldo was trying to justify like being on Fox. And here is Fox and Friends, Ainsley Earhart, suggesting that maybe, hopefully, there'll be a war in Syria, so we don't have to hear so much about this Comey stuff.
Geraldo, if the president in the UK and France if the president in France and the UK decide to strike Syria, don't you think that story would be a bigger story than Comey's book that's released on Tuesday?
Again, I apologize for the delay in stepping on you, Ainsley, but I think that the United States, the United Kingdom, and France certainly have the military wherewithal. Indeed, the United States could do it on its own, strike Syria, strike Assad's resources, military assets, in retaliation for the gas attack, the horrifying gas attack.
That wasn't really the question, Geraldo.
Well, I mean,
but can we get Comey out of the cycle? You got to stay focused in my morning briefing.
First of all, I love how they're talking about it now as if it's like some big coalition of the willing.
Right.
And but then the idea that Geraldo now, it must be, you know, after his exchange with Bill Maher, must be super sensitive to this thing. Because he clearly was not going to answer that question. Like,
right, you just really on national. You're like, Fox is real news. Do I think we should engage in war to specifically change a news cycle as a setup question on a news hit? I'm going to focus on the hardware we have.
I hope him and Bill Maher literally kill each other, like Game of Thrones style, Mountain versus Viper.
It's
wow.
Possible.
That's gruesome. Sudan only kept the goddamn dress out of the news cycle for a day, so I can tell you unequivocally no. And I did, because I probably still do talk with Donald Trump on the phone.
Yeah.
Give him advice from time to time.
I got a little something for you. Run this little play.
Yeah, run this play. You think that bombing place in the Middle East will change the cycle? Well, I can assure you it won't.
No. It probably should for at least a little bit. I do think that if we engage in a war with Syria, it would be slightly more important than James Comey's book tour. But
I think we're actually in a stage of hyper-normalization where it would be like, oh, we're bombing Syria. James Comey just said that Trump asked if they could compare penis sizes. I think I know which one I'm reading.
Seriously,
do you think we could get James Comey on to ask him his opinion about the bombing of Syria? Then we could.
Yeah. Should this disrupt us focusing on your book?
They don't understand the media.
Who doesn't understand the media?
The folks who think that what you just said, that any kind of boring war story would overshadow a Trump penis story.
I mean, there was a time where that calculation made some sense, at least to a certain extent. And I'm not as convinced that the bombing in Sudan did not at least time for Clinton. And
it was a more regal time.
That
you
was
could
a
bomb
time.
A pharmaceutical the company.
Reagan's invasion of... Reagan's invasion of the Falklands, I think, if I remember correctly, took a lot of...
Wait, you mean Grenada, right?
Grenada, I'm sorry, took a lot of the attention away from, I mean, you can't take it all, but from the death of the Marines in Lebanon. I think it was 265 Marines. And so there is some reason for them to believe it, but the amazing... What I always found amazing about that clip, too, is just the way the question was phrased. Like, don't you think that if we do bomb Syria, shouldn't it be appropriate that that is a bigger story than Comey? Like, it's just, it's a very weird time.
It's an insane time. Although, that Reagan story is pretty insane. Hezbollah kills a bunch of troops, and our answer is to go invade a sovereign democratic socialist experiment in the Southern Caribbean with
under
a million
fair,
people. That is somewhat crazy as well.
Under a million
really
people.
Weird.
How many people live in Guyana?
Guyana.
Grenada.
Oh, sorry. I think it's possibly smaller than Worcester, Massachusetts. But it was all about
Soviet influence.
No, it was about our medical students who were there.
What?
Yeah. It's
all about our medical students who weren't good enough to go to mainland universities. We need to go engage in blatant imperialism for those that just could not get a good medical entrance exam and are partying in the Caribbean. Now a bunch of crazy black people are threatening them. How about we not pay attention to Lebanon now?
Meanwhile, we are starting to see people reposition themselves for 2020, or in some instances, just position themselves for 2020. And Cory Booker's project continues. He had the opportunity to, in Secretary of State, and these are the nomination hearings, or I should say confirmation hearings, of Mike Pompeo to be Secretary of State, Cory Booker addressed Pompeo's past history of, or I guess that's the only type of history, a history of consorting with some really popular Islamophobes.
Like John Bolton?
When it comes to making sure that we don't have terrorists brewing in places that where Muslims congregate, there's a special place, right? It's more than a duty, more than a require. It's an opportunity, right? To be treated as when someone from another faith says it can get characterized.
So if I can go on, because I have some more questions. So you think that Muslims in America who are in positions of leadership have a different category of obligation because of their religion? That's what I'm hearing you saying.
I don't see it. It's not an obligation. It's an opportunity.
Okay, so it's interesting. I do believe, though, all of us, when this comes to violent action.
Pause it for 1 second, okay? This is something that, I guess we haven't talked about in a while. But the obligation, or I should say the idea that Muslims had a sort of an extra obligation to prove that they were Americans by doing more than any other Americans in terms of fighting terrorism was a big narrative for a while. That, you would hear, this guy fought, was a veteran and fought, and, it is a... That made them real Americans, or they were willing to spy on their community. That made them real Americans. And that concept, I don't know, it's pretty funny. It's a real opportunity to prove you're American. And not a lot of people get that opportunity because they're just, unfortunately for them, they're just, white Christians and don't
they don't have an opportunity to have spies in their churches.
They don't have the special opportunity to prove that they're American because everybody just knows they are. Continue.
I do believe, though, all of us, when this comes to violent actions or even violent words, have an obligation. And so I'm wondering, sir, do you know Frank Gaffney?
Yes, I do.
Oh, God.
And you've been on his show dozens of times.
I was on his show some, yes, Senator.
I have here over 20 times. And he has talked about Muslims should be... Who abide by the adherence of their faith should be considered, should be tried for acts of sedition and should be prosecuted. Did you remain silent when you were on his show? Did you ever question? Because I have a lot of his statements here. Mm-hmm. Did you remain silent on the, and he's, from my notes at least, you're a friend of his. Were you silent in your position of authority against these words that are violative of the American Constitution? Were you silent with him?
Senator, my record on this is unambiguous.
Sir, if that's your response, you did not say anything to call out his remarks. What about Bridget Gabriel? Do you know her?
I do.
Someone who runs an organization that has been considered a hate group by the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center. Were you silent? Did you ever call her out on her remarks that are hateful or bigoted?
Senator, I've spoken to a number of groups, and I believe my record with respect to tolerance and the equal treatment of people.
Did you ever call her out?
Senator, I couldn't tell you. I don't recall each statement I've made over 54 years.
Okay.
I don't remember. It's going to be interesting to see if Pompeo's going to. I mean, there is an opportunity, I would imagine, to not confirm this guy, but who knows?
Did Hillary help shape those answers? Rand Paul? No other Republican besides him is going to oppose this guy.
Unlikely, yeah. But who knows? Maybe someone wants to strengthen their never-Trumper bona fides.
You know, I think it's, you know, obviously totally nonsense, but great opportunity to, hold Jeff Flake to his, sanctimonious rhetoric here.
Good luck with that as well.
Good luck with all of them. I mean, it's not going to happen, right. But I'm saying there you go. I mean, isn't Flake, one of his objections to Trump is overt bigotry, supposedly. Well, here you go.
I can't wait for Paul Ryan to, sit in the audience and then pull off a protest shirt and stop the hearings.
These firings are just giving anti-Trump politicians more chances to grill people on TV. It's like an extension of the campaign. So thanks, I guess.
Yeah, it would be nice. I guess so. I mean, I don't know. Hope springs eternal.
Like, I don't think that's what Democrats are going to win on, but yeah, it never hurts, I suppose, to trot out one of these ghouls and grill them in front of everyone.
Well, of course. I mean, this is part of their job to theoretically question and, raise these things to put people on alert, to create the narrative so that people keep an eye on it. Hopefully they'll be effective, at least in that regard. All right, I've got to wrap up in about 10 minutes, but I want to play this clip. This is from a couple of days ago. He is a California sheriff, apparently caught on videotape, telling employees that it's... who is he speaking to, Youngblood? I'm not clear on this.
He's in like a room. I'm not sure. We can look it up while we play.
Okay. Well, here is the Kem County, California sheriff, and.
Well, is this the employees' union? That's what it says in the description, or no?
I don't know what an employees'
like
union
a police
is.
Union. I mean,
is
assuming,
it a police union?
That's what the LA Times says. Employees' union. I'm assuming it's a police union, but I mean.
And. It is, to be fair, 12 years old, and he's making a financial assessment. The union is that represents the Kem County jailers is endorsing Youngblood's opponent in the upcoming election. So it would appear that the union actually released this as a way of making it clear to people that this guy may not be the best sheriff.
When you lose the support of the cops unions, that's really bad.
Right. This guy's, yeah. When you're too violent for the cop union. But here it is. Listen to this. This is pretty shocking, actually.
Oh, I think that detention deputies receive more training probably today than a deputy sheriff ever did when he worked in jail. If that's what you're asking.
Period. Nobody in operation.
Absolutely. Yes. And there's a good reason for that. Millions and millions of dollars. You don't see the loss. You know what happens when a guy makes a bad shooting on somebody and kills them? $3 million, the family goes away after a long back and forth and back and forth. When it happens in corrections, it's a totally different ballgame. If you stack on top of that, an inmate that's in restraint, if you tack on top of that the number of officers that may or may not be involved, if you tack on top of that the setting that you're in, that is absolutely huge. It's no different than when a deputy shoots someone in the streets. Which way do you think is better financially? To cripple them or kill them? For the county.
Sure.
Absolutely. Because if cripple, you got to take care of it for life. And that cost goes way up. And the same thing happens to a deputy that occurs in the direction. And I don't know this for a fact, but I'll bet you since the incident occurred, every time an inmate dies and they're new, they wasn't, so they're all over.
Yeah, there you go. He's complaining about when a suspect dies. The news is all over it, but it is financially more advantageous for the county to shoot someone dead than to shoot them and permanently injure them, because the county needs to pay more to the family for the health care for this critically injured person who will need this care for the rest of their life.
Who is this guy?
And they have followed through on that, too. This is, as I understand it, one of the deadliest sheriff departments in America.
Well, that's what the training is, very cost effective.
Deadly or most efficient?
Right. Jamie,
right.
So cynical.
Yeah.
Always looking at
someone
that.
Someone doesn't understand how the numbers work.
All right, well, I've got to. Oh, should we do this? Okay, good. Good. Let's play this. This last clip we have of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, and Ariel Elise Gold confront U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley about her blocking an investigation, a UN investigation, into the Israeli really massacres of Palestinian protesters in Gaza. I mean, you've seen the clips of snipers killing members of the press, killing people who were
praying,
ready to roll tires at them. Here is a clip of Code Pink going and confronting Nikki Haley.
We wonder why you're blocking an investigation into the Israeli use of excessive force in Gaza. The international community would like that investigation to go forward. You know, Israel deserves to be held accountable just like any other country.
The killing of peaceful protesters, including a journalist wearing a press vest in Gaza, and the UN is being blocked from investigating.
She's attending as a guest right now.
Well, we're all here as guests.
She's not attending as...
We're all guests.
I love that. I love the fact that, she's here as a guest. She's not allowed to talk about anything. That's dinner conversation.
You know, and what's amazing is that, I mean, probably under Clinton it would have gotten, you know, I think there wouldn't be much difference, honestly. But under Obama there was a slight, you know, there was that one motion on settlements in 2016, I think, at the very end where the Obama administration abstained. And there was a slight inch towards not protecting Israel, no matter, with just the unbelievable impunity that they operate with over everything, including this. I mean,
yep.
This video footage, like, I don't even, it couldn't speak for itself more. I mean, there's just no ambiguity to it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think Clinton would have been much more likely to stop an investigation like this than the Obama administration. But of course, the big difference would be it would be a major story, as opposed to, like, it's somewhere down like the 15th story of the of the day.
Right. She would do exactly what she did when they confronted her about Iraq. She would pretend to listen to them, you know, invite them into her office, smile, nod, and then do exactly what she wanted to do.
Well, yeah, well,
that's better. Actually, I mean, because the Democratic Party, if they're getting to a point where people at least have to acknowledge that concern, that's already a distinction. But
well, she pretended to acknowledge it.
And to be fair, even Tim Kaine, at least boycotted the address by Netanyahu to Congress.
We should change his name to Even Tim Kaine.
Exactly. Exactly. When Tim Kaine is the voice of reason, you know you've got a problem.
They do some good stuff, Code Pink.
Yeah, they do. They've been at it for a long time. I remember the RNC in 2004. There was a number of Code Pink people who were who interrupted Bush's speech at the time. Maybe two. Pretty brave people.
Frankly. My mom was telling me about their protest. She was in D.C. protesting the inauguration. She's like, they were very organized. Very good.
No, they're good at what they do.
Nice.
All right. Well, folks, that's it for today. We will be back, or I will be back, live in studio on Monday. Don't forget, this show relies on your support.
Just Coffee.
If you... Oh, right. Darn
Sorry.
It.
It's on the blog post.
Okay. Just Coffee is offering 30% off their coffees this month only. You don't need a coupon code. Just go to justcoffee.coop. 30% off. This is the time to try Just Coffee. If you have ever heard me talk about Just Coffee and said, I don't want to risk it. I don't want to try. This is the time to try Just Coffee. 30% off, free shipping. You can try their, they've got their coffee sourced from many different countries. It's all fair trade. They have different roasts, you know, dark, medium, light. And now is the time. You can try the Majority Report blend. If you really must, you can try the WTF blend. I'm not sure why you would do that. But head over to justcoffee.coop, 30% off. They're a great, obviously, co-op-run business. Also, the show relies on its members for its support. Join themajorityreport.com. Check out this week's TMBS. You can sign up on iTunes or on our YouTube channel. Check out Jamie's Patreon. It is pay what you want. Situation over there, so you can read her stuff and check out the Antifada podcast.
We're having Doug Henwood and Liza Featherstone on our episode that we're recording this weekend, actually, and it is free to listen to. But if you would like to join our new Discord community and submit questions for Liza to answer on the show, because she gives great advice, check it out.
All right, folks, we will see you on Monday. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I shifted in and out of gear, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how.